All right, good morning. We'll call the meeting to order. And I welcome the Public Accounts Committee, public hearing, respect for the Public Accounts Consolidated Summary, Financial Restatement of the Year Ended March 31st, 2023, and the Auditor General Report of the Province's 2023 Financial Statement Audits. The committee wishes to thank various witnesses from the concerned entities who will appear before the committee throughout the day. We also acknowledge the Deputy Auditor General and the office of that office and the officials of that office who are attending today as well. I remind members and officials to turn the mic on when you wish to speak and turn it off each time you are finished. There's a button there at the bottom that you can use. My name is Pleeman Forsey, MHA for Exploits, and Chair of the Public Accounts Committee. Before we proceed, I will provide the committee members the opportunity to introduce themselves, starting with the member from my right.
Lucy Stoyles, Mount Pearl North.
Good morning, Sherry Gammon Walsh, CMHA for Placentia St. Mary's.
Jordan Brown, the MHA for Labrador West.
And Perry Trimper, MHA for Lake Melville.
Good morning, Jody Wall, MHA Cape St. Francis.
Thank you. The Standing Committee on Public Accounts is dedicated to improving the public administration in partnership with the Auditor General. The committee examines and the administration of government policy, not on the merits of it, and strives to achieve consensus in its decisions whenever possible. Members take a nonpartisan approach to their work on each of those committees. The committee will hear from several entities today in the following order. For the morning portion of the hearing are the witnesses from the Office of the Comptroller General, Treasury Board, Secretariat, and Department of Finance. Next, for the first portion of the afternoon, we will have witnesses from the Department of Health and Community Services and Newfoundland and Labrador Health Services. And finally, this afternoon, we will have the Department of Children, Seniors, and Social Development. Before we start with matters under consideration first today, I wish to welcome from the Office of the Auditor General, Deputy Auditor General Sandra Russell, Assistant Auditor General Financial Brian O'Neill, Manager of Communications, Office of the Auditor General, Krista Collins. We will now turn our attention to the first entities we will be hearing from today, the Office of the Comptroller General, Treasury Board Secretariat, and Department of Finance. I would like to thank the witnesses for these appearance to welcoming the following officials: Bren Hanlon, Comptroller General; Lisa Warren, Director of Government Accounting; Elizabeth Lane, Secretary to Treasury Board; Michelle Jewer, Deputy Minister of Finance. I will start with a few reminders for the witnesses and an outline of how hearing will proceed before I call the clerk to swear and affirm the witnesses. Witnesses are reminded that this public meeting and your testimony here today will be part of the public record. Witnesses appearing before the Standing Committee of the House of Assembly are entitled to the same privileges granted to members respecting parliamentary privilege. Witnesses may speak freely, and what you say in this parliamentary proceeding may not be used against you in civil proceedings. Live audio will be streamed on the House of Assembly social media channels. An archived version will be available following the hearing. Answered will also be available once finalized. When called upon to speak, please activate your microphone, identify yourself by saying your name first, and please remember to turn your mic off once you've finished speaking. First, I'll invite the Comptroller General, Secretary to Treasury Board, and Deputy of, Minister of Finance to make opening remarks. Then the committee members will pose questions in a turn of 10-minute periods. These rounds will continue until the committee have exhausted their questions on the matters. I now ask the clerk to administer the oaths and to affirm witnesses.
I, Michelle Jewer, do solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm and declare that the evidence that I shall give on this examination shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I, Elizabeth Lane, do solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm and declare that the evidence that I shall give on this examination shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I, Brendan Hanlon, do solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm and declare that the evidence that I shall give on this examination shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I, Lisa Warren, do solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm and declare that the evidence that I shall give on this examination shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Thank you. I now call upon the Comptroller General to bring opening remarks.
Thank you, MHA 4C. So first of all, I'd like to thank the Public Accounts Committee for asking us here today. I'd like to introduce myself and the staff I have with me here today. So my name is Brendan Hanlon, Comptroller General of Finance with Treasury Board Secretariat. And I have with me Lisa Warren, Director of Government Accounting. So I'm just going to make a short opening statement to let everybody know what we do at the Office of the Comptroller General, and then the Deputy Ministers will introduce themselves. So the Office of the Comptroller General is a branch of Treasury Board Secretariat. Along with the Department of Finance, we administer the Financial Administration Act to ensure adequate control of overall government revenues, expenditures, assets, and liabilities. So we develop government-wide financial and accounting policies and procedures, provide transaction processing services for payments made to government and received by government. We provide internal audit services to government departments, entities, and support the work of government's audit committee and oversee government's fraud management program. We're responsible for the administration, processing, and compliance of payroll, leave and time attendance transactions for over 30,000 government employees, teachers, and pensioners. And to facilitate these activities, we're also responsible for several of government's largest financial and payroll systems. The Office of the Comptroller General also supports government's audit committee in its work related to internal audit, public accounts, fraud management, advocacy, and ethics responsibility. We are a professional accounting organization. We're committed to ensuring we meet our accounting standards, and which allows for clean, unqualified audit opinion on the financial statements of the province. Finally, the Office of the Comptroller General is a supporter of the role and mandate of the Auditor General in their work on the public accounts, performance audits, and other work. And we look forward to continuing this relationship. Thank you. That's our opening remarks.
Thank you. I now call upon the Secretary to Treasury Board to bring opening remarks.
Elizabeth Lane, Secretary to Treasury Board. As the Comptroller General has stated, part of my responsibility is oversight of Treasury Board Secretariat. Treasury Board Secretariat has approximately 270 employees across four branches of government: Treasury Board Operations, Human Resources, Evaluation and Accountability, and Office of the Comptroller General. I'm very happy to be here and happy to take questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. I now call upon the Deputy Minister of Finance to bring opening remarks.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me here today as part of this group to answer questions on public accounts. Department of Finance, I'm Deputy Minister of Department of Finance. So we work very closely with both Treasury Board Secretariat and Office of Comptroller General throughout the year and during public accounts as well. But we do have a little bit of a different mandate than Treasury Board Secretariat. So the Department of Finance are responsible for fiscal, financial, statistical, and economic policy. We provide advice to Cabinet, obviously, and other government departments and agencies. We are responsible for the provincial budget and the administration of provincial tax statutes, management of provincial borrowing and debt, and project analysis, economic and fiscal forecasting, negotiation of federal transfers, and representing the province on national and fiscal and statistical matters. So thanks for having me here today, and looking forward to your questions.
Okay, thank you. With that, I guess I'll now recognize the member for Mount Pearl North to proceed with the questioning.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming, and of course the Auditor General's office and her staff and their staff for coming today, and of course my colleagues for being here today. In the Auditor General report, she noticed that the books remain open for 1 month after the yearly fiscal invoice process, and I'm just wondering, have you looked at any changes in that? Because apparently we're the only province in Canada that does that. We're just wondering what the practice is going to be moving forward.
Brendan Hanlon, Controller General of Finance. So every province treats the chargeback period differently. So the chargeback period is 30 days after the end of March. So we're legislatively required to have that chargeback period of 30 days. So it allows for expenses that come in late related to prior previous year to be charged to the correct fiscal year. Of course, that does result in additional time required to complete the public accounts audit because we need 30 days for the books to close. Right now, we're not looking at any changes to that requirement, but as I said, different provinces do it differently all across the island. And, you know, it may be something we'll look at in the future, but right now, we're not looking at that particular process.
Okay, so how frequent does the Office of the Controller General review allowances to identify any accounts for which there was no reasonable, you know, recovery?
Brendan Hanlon, Controller General of Finance. So annually, departments are required to submit accounts receivable and allowance for doubtful accounts updates. So we're continually reviewing those accounts. Of course, you know, the larger accounts receivable are like income support and outstanding fines. We're continually working with departments to sort of identify whether accounts should be written off or submitted for write-off, and we will provide advice and guidance on the write-off process. We want to have correct accounting for all our assets and liabilities, which would include accounts receivable and any allowances that are set up. So we're continually working with departments to ensure those balances are correct and up to date.
So since the Auditor General's report was released, and of course your department has received a copy, what changes has the department made for compliance?
With respect to accounts receivable?
Yes.
Okay, so as part of the 2024 public accounts, we communicated clearly with all departmental executive and controllers to raise awareness of the issue of having up-to-date accounts receivable and allowance for doubtful accounts. We have reiterated the requirement for departments to review accounts receivable, in particular the non-trade receivables and allowances such as income support and fines receivable. And we have asked them to consider write-offs in all instances where it's appropriate, which is usually statute-barred accounts, bankruptcies, or deceased. So income support are making a special effort to update their balances and write-offs as appropriate.
So,
and just a note, the representative from the income support will be here later this afternoon discussing income support accounts further.
Yes, thank you. So I'm assuming that after 7 years and they're on the books and they're not receiving anything, are they automatically taken off of the books then, or how is that process working? Is that still the same as it has been in the past?
Brendan Hanlon. So statute-barred accounts are generally 6 years with no activity on the account. You know, there are exceptions to those circumstances, but once the 6 years are up, generally speaking, the department would be required to submit a write-off to Treasury Board. Anything under $1,000, the Deputy Minister can write it off, and then our internal audit would follow up on those write-offs. Anything over $1,000 would have to come to Treasury Board. So that's a process that's been in place for quite a while now.
So in collecting, the accounts that you're collecting on a regular basis, you're only allowed, if somebody is still remaining on income support, you're only allowed to take a percentage of their income support. Can you explain that process to us?
Brendan Hanlon. Yes, so if you're an active income support client, generally it's 5% of your income support payment is taken towards your overpayment. So overpayments can be for a variety of reasons. If someone gets a damage deposit for an apartment, for instance, that could be set up as an overpayment. So, you know, overpayments are set up for a number of different reasons. So 5% is taken off the income support check. Once they are inactive from income support, Then that collection activity goes over to DGSNL, who has a collection section that then takes over a collection of that account.
Okay, so after the 6 years is up and you know you can and can do an automatic within $1,000, is there any way? It's automatically dated and after 6 years, is what you're saying. If somebody was to win the lottery and they still owed $20,000 for income support, is there any way of recovering that?
My understanding of statute barred is that once the 6 years are up, there is no sort of legal ability to collect that funding, to collect that money once the 6 years is up and the statute barred, which is why it would then normally get routed directly for a write-off at that point.
Yes, so but if they're paying the 5% and they're still in the books and they're paying, they're still, if they took 10 years or 15 years, a year out, even after the 6 years is up, will you continue taking that 5% or is the account considered dead?
Again, Brendan Hanlon, my understanding is that if you're an active income support client and the 5% is coming up, that counts as acknowledgement of the debt. So therefore, statute barred wouldn't be in effect on that debt. It would be continual to be paid. And oftentimes it would take, you know, depending on the size of the debt at 5%, it may take a while to collect, but it would not become statute barred during an active collection, we'll say. That's my understanding.
So if somebody is not on income support and they've gone to work, you can deduct their wages and take the amounts of the wages, and that's not the 5%, right?
Brendan Hanlon, correct. So there are a number of tools that DGSNL would use. Federal set-off is one. So they could put someone in federal set-off. If they get an income tax return, that would be applied against their income support overpayment. They can set up repayment arrangements with people. They could do wage attachments on people. So they use a number of different tools to collect once you become inactive from income support.
Is there any avenue for an appeal once they're deemed to owe the money? I'm dealing with a case now, so I'm asking this. And they've said right from the get-go they didn't owe the money and they've been fighting it from the get-go. Is there any way of a further appeal for them to come back and say to the Auditor General and to you guys that they can come back and have a second look at the account?
Brendan Hanlon, and I'm just going to put a caveat on this. You can confirm with CSSD this afternoon, but my understanding is that there's an income support appeal board that would hear those types of issues, not the Controller General. It's handled by the income support appeal board. That's my understanding, to be clarified with CSSD.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to move on to... Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll now ask the member for Placentia St. Mary's.
Good morning. I'm just going to focus on the three-piece public-private partnerships right now. So the AG notes a continuing issue regarding the review of inflation rates used in calculating contractual obligations relating to P3s. When does the Office of the Controller General intend to conduct a sensitivity analysis to explain any potential impacts of a change in inflation rates on the total value of P3's contractual obligations?
Brendan Hanlon. So I'm happy to report that we have worked with the Department of Health and Community Services and updated contractual obligation disclosures to reflect inflation rates built into P3 agreements for our operating payments. So we have taken that step. We have taken the advice of the Auditor General and implemented that step.
Okay.
On the second part, the sensitivity analysis. Mm-hmm. So we're reviewing options to provide sensitivity analysis if it's materially warranted in future public accounts. So we're just looking at the impact if, you know, rates go up or down. Is it material to the public accounts? And so once we've done some analysis and determined if it should or should not be included in the public accounts, if we determine that it should be included, then it will be included. So we're considering that alternative, but we have already implemented the impact of interest rates on P3s.
Okay. What exactly are you doing to review the inflation rate used when calculating the contractual obligations? What exactly is done?
Right. So, Brendan Hanlon. So we would look at incremental increases or decreases in the rates and the amount of money that would impact on the public accounts themselves. So, you know, if the amount is relatively small, I mean, if it's immaterial, Should it be included or not? That's sort of a question for our office, but that's what we do. We look at if the rate goes down by a certain percentage, what is the impact? And if the rate goes up by a certain percentage, what would the impact? But, you know, it's all sort of predicated on the fact that nobody really knows which way the rates are going to go. So therefore, you know, what sort of level of changes should we be looking at? So, you know, that's those are the things we're looking at.
Okay, thank you. Loans. So just specifically about loans, how frequently does the Office of the Comptroller General review allowances to identify any accounts for which there is no reason? Like, how often do you actually do that probability of recovery?
Brendan Hanlon. So we did a specific project this year. Our internal audit completed a review of loans receivable and requested write-offs for 11 of those 35 accounts. So there were 35 loans. Internal audit did an initial first look, and they decided that 11 of those loans should be submitted for write-off. So then departments were requested to review the remaining 24 loans, and complete write-offs were necessary. And financial statements were updated for 2024. So altogether, 19 accounts of 35 were written off.
Okay.
One is currently in process, which would make it 20, if it's approved, of course, by Treasury Board. And of the 14 loans remaining, one has since been repaid, and one is a conditionally repayable loan. So really, there are 12 of 35 accounts remaining. So we did a concerted effort this year to look at all 35 accounts and take action where necessary.
Okay, thank you. So my colleague was referring to accounts receivable, like doubtful accounts. And we had quite a discussion about this yesterday, and I'm just wondering, like, and I know this is probably for CSSD also, but there is that probability, like, of somebody winning the lottery, and you got your 6 years or whatever. I actually know a case where someone did win the lottery and paid back what they owed. But when people, like, there seems like there's a significant amount of money owed on the books, and I understand there's like just potential of estates, but you use like the 6-7 years there. So is it beyond your control? Does it then go to Treasury Board, and Treasury Board totally decides if that is written off or not?
So, sorry, Brendan Hand, do you mean if it's beyond the 6 years or just within?
Beyond.
So I'll just add, and again, CSSD may have additional to add this afternoon, like there are things they can do, like certificates of judgment and whatnot, okay, to expand the collection period beyond 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there are tools they can take if they feel, like, you know, it might depend on the size. If someone owes a large amount of money, they could seek a certificate of judgment, which would, I think, extend it an additional 10 years. So, you know, those steps are worth taking if the amount of the overpayment you know, indicates that they should take additional steps.
Okay.
So then, usually the department would make the sort of decision that this is now beyond 6 years, so we cannot submit it for write-off. And if they did submit it for write-off, it would be sort of not legal because there's no longer the ability to collect that money. The you know, the law says that debt is no longer recoverable.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
So just go to inventory management. The AG notes in the report that inventory management is a large area of risk for the government. How is government working to ensure that inventory count guidelines are followed and that documented policies are in place?
Okay, so Brendan Hanlon, Department, Office of the Comptroller General. So we're taking a sort of different approach this year, and we have implemented an inventory guideline for departments. So we have formalized an inventory guideline, like to tell them steps they should be taking every year. We have sat down with departmental controllers. We have quarterly meetings with departmental controllers to outline the steps they should be taking for inventory control. This year, we will be implementing spot checks. Our internal audit division will be doing spot checks on inventory. So that's sort of a new thing we're going to be doing, just to sort of add additional validity to the reports that are coming in for departmental inventory. And we have communicated to a departmental executive the sort of need to get inventories updates in on time and ensure they're accurate and timely. So those are the steps we've taken. So new guidelines, and we're going to be doing spot checks on inventory and communication to controllers and executive.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. 3 minutes. So bank reconciliations, we noted that they're not being completed at year end. Can you just comment on that?
Yes, I can. Brendan Hanlon. So last year, there were three instances of bank recs going beyond 60 days is the sort of policy in place for having bank recs completed. So my understanding is there were a couple of year-end bank reconciliations that went beyond 60 days. I think they may have been 70 days. And part of it had to do with the write-back period. So, you know, year-end, we need a bit of additional time to get bank reconciliations done. But for this year, we are going to ensure that all bank reconciliations are done within the 60-day time frame.
Just an additional question to that. Mm-hmm. Have you found that, like, you may have, like, 4 or 5 months a bank that's not completed? Like, are we looking back at October, November, December, and you're into March? Is that happening?
Right now, that is not happening. Mm-hmm. So all bank recs are being done within the 60-day time frame right now.
Okay. All right, thank you. The unfunded pension liability. Has government reviewed this pension plan to determine if action is needed to ensure its continued sustainability?
Elizabeth Lane. So government is responsible for a number of different pension plans. In terms of direct responsibility, there's the pooled pension plans.
Yeah.
They include the Uniform Services Pension Plan, as well as the MHA Pension Plan, as well as the Provincial Court Judges Pension Plan. And there are various levels of funding status for each of these plans. I'm just, I guess, wondering which specific plan that you're referencing.
Uniform? Specifically?
Yeah, currently the Uniform Services Pension Plan has a funded status of between 25 and 26%. Government is aware of the nature of the funding status of that plan and is currently reviewing options to address that issue.
Okay. All right, thank you. That's all my questions right now. Pass it on to me.
Okay, thank you. We'll ask the member for Lab West to question.
Thank you so much, Chair. My first question, I guess, is on the $660 million line of credit with the Newfoundland Labor Health, held by different entities of the Newfoundland Labor Health Services, the Auditor General made a note of its sustainability. That I just want to know what is from the, I guess, the perspective of the group before me, is this a sustainable, I guess, debt that is possibly within there, or is there any issues within the department on the $660 million line of credit with the Newfoundland Labor Health Services?
I'm Michelle Jewer. So certainly a large line of credit for NL Health Services. We are continuing to work with the department and NLH services on how to manage that line of credit. In budget 2024, there was additional funds allocated to NLHS to help address that issue, and we're continuing to work with them on bringing that down.
Thank you. Just I guess the follow up on that is the sustainability. I guess your answer is that it is sustainable, or is there some concern for sustainability going into the future with that?
So Michelle Jewer, I'm not sure I can answer that particular question around sustainability. We're continuing to work with them to find options to address the line of credit. So currently, their line of credit, the interest they pay on line of credit, for example, is higher than our cost of borrowing for government. So we're looking at options on how to, what's the best way to fund that shortfall.
Thank you so much. I guess moving on to asset retirement obligations. The Auditor General noted that a lot of, buildings and other assets that will require this, or it's not currently, I guess, an operating policy right now. What is the department or the Treasury Board or, the Office of Comptroller General, where are we with the asset retirement obligations, given, a lot of buildings and stuff are seeing their end date coming up soon, or being, you see there's some new buildings that are being replaced, older buildings, aging infrastructure. Where are we to with that in the policy?
Brendan Hanlon, Comptroller General. So we have a policy in place now where all departments have to report changes to their asset retirement obligations to my office on a monthly basis. We have developed a formal business process for reassessing and updating asset retirement obligations regularly. The process ensures accuracy and completeness of the information used to calculate asset retirement obligations. We requested the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure to complete 5%, a review of 5% of their total assets in the ARO, which was around 40 buildings. So they've completed that the past year. So we're going to sort of do a rolling, update from departments on asset retirement obligations. And sort of the process we developed will be reviewed by the Office of the Auditor General to ensure that they agree with the process and position we're taking on asset retirement obligations.
Thank you, Comptroller General. And with the asset, retirement obligations and that, and you're having like some monthly reports and everything like that, are we going to see a more robust plan for retirement of assets, or is there any concern there that we're only doing this now and some of the aging buildings are coming up faster, a lot of infrastructure is now severely aged in this province. Is there any concern there?
MHJ Brown, do you mean sort of future infrastructure investments or
current infrastructure investment?
I guess I'll pass it off to Michelle, but I mean, my office wouldn't necessarily comment on future infrastructure investments. I mean, we would record asset retirement obligations, make sure government's aware of the condition of the assets, but respect to future investments, of course, my office wouldn't comment on that.
I ask you to repeat the question, I'm sorry.
With the current assets now, like I said, we weren't tracking retirement obligations with current assets now, and we have a significant amount of aged and aging building and some infrastructure that's going to soon be replaced. Are we in a good place with asset retirement obligations? Are we going to be able to meet those needs because we weren't tracking it before?
So Michelle Dewar, so certainly that's something that we look at when we're looking at current infrastructure as well as new, like from, for example, the sustaining capital piece of keeping that infrastructure in good condition. So that is something that we look at when we're looking at a budget for a particular project. Does that answer your question?
Thank you so much. Moving on to inventory management, I know my previous colleague talked about it, but in the report, I guess they signal out TI with some of the, issues with the inventory management and, going back, given that, my question, would be is, given that some of this has not been followed up on and there's been issues with inventory management going back, what is, the plan for reconcile or to get there? Because if there's a significant issue now and once you, the comptroller mentioned about some new procedure and that, what is the plan for reconciling some of the, issues that are going to probably arise from where missing inventory or inventory that was not properly logged. Is there a plan in place to deal with that?
Brendan Hanlon. So I wouldn't presuppose that there's going to be issues coming up with the inventory. But like I said, our internal audit section will be doing spot checks on inventory to ensure validity. We communicated with executive the sort of, necessity to tighten up all inventory controls and inventory management. And of course, if issues would happen to arise with any of the inventory, then the department will work with the department to sort of remedy those issues. But, we couldn't presuppose that there will be any at this point.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that if there's going to be an issue with reconciliation on inventory, I just wanted to know if there's a plan in place or if there's anything that the department's looking at or anything like that to make sure that, we have a process for us, given that, we've had issues in the past, keeping track of inventory in this province.
Again, Brendan Hanlon. The Office of the Controller General has zero tolerance for any fraud whatsoever. So if anything comes up in our review of inventory, then we will work with the department to remedy that situation.
Yep. Thank you. And finally, with the pension liabilities, especially with the uniform pension, I know that my colleague asked about it, and then we mentioned that there is work, identifying anything like that. But can we get some timeline or anything on this work or this work that's going to be to reconcile that deficit in that pension? The uniform one is the one that was signaled out in the report as being one of the most underfunded ones. Is there any work or timelines or anything like that we can see on addressing those issues?
Elizabeth Lane. I can verify that, as I stated previously, government is aware of the funding status of that plan and the issues with the funding status. Work is ongoing in terms of an analysis of options to address the funding status of the plan. I don't today have a timeline or an expected time as to how long that will take, but I can confirm that the analysis is ongoing. Thank you.
Yeah. I know previously, in when it comes to underfunding pensions and that there has to be certain, I guess, permissions and stuff given, is the government allowed of the underfunding? I know, when dealing with the Wabash Mines workers and that, the company went to the government, asked for permission to underfund the plan. Did government give itself permission, or is there any promissory note or anything like that attached to this plan for the allowance of its underfunding?
Elizabeth Lane, with respect to the Uniform Services Pension Plan and a couple of other pension plans as well, the Pensions Benefits Act regulations exempt the USPP from the requirements to fund financial deficiencies, which has been a longstanding exemption. So there is legislation that backs the deficiency in the Uniform Services Pension Plan.
Thank you. That's my final question.
Thank you. We'll now call upon the member for Lake Melville. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to go back to... first of all, I just wanted to check, Brendan, when you were talking about decision-making around write-offs, there's another threshold above 5,000. Is that when Cabinet gets involved? Treasury Board is there and those representatives, but is there a point at which the entire Cabinet, I've served in Cabinet, I'm just trying to recall, but put it up.
So there are settlement limits are $5,000. So if government wants to settle an outstanding debt with somebody, and the sort of variance between the amount they want to settle at and the amount of the original debt is greater than $5,000, then that's when that particular incentive will kick in.
Okay. Yeah. All right, thanks. I'd like to follow up on my colleague from Lab West's line of questioning around assets. And I'm going to go a little bit off topic here, but I'm going to stay on the topic, but I want to look at it from a couple different angles, because I think as an MHA, I'm aware of several assets that are sitting on the books, not available for use by government, not available for use by the private sector, and they just seem to be stalled year after year. And I'm trying to think of a way to overcome that. And I've got buildings in my district of Lake Melville that I've had inquiries. I'm just looking to see if there's some more transparency that could be provided. I remember years ago, around 2016 and so on, we did a review of our footprint and looked at our space, and we radically pulled back, so much lease space, underutilized, and so on. Is there any mechanism, and or have we ever engaged something similar to look at assets that really we don't seem to have any use, yet are still sitting there, languishing away, and with a building up of liability?
Brendan Hanlon. So MHA Trimper, good question. The Department of Transportation and Infrastructure are responsible for, basically all space within the government envelope. So I would suggest that, if you want to reach out to Transportation Infrastructure, they should be able to provide that information for you. Of course, the Office of Controller General would not have that information, but mm-hmm. Transportation Infrastructure are responsible for all space requirements, is my understanding, within government.
Understand. And I'm doing that, and it's working. It's a little slow. And I just wondered if there was any direction, or would you guys ever consider providing that direction to all departments who may have assets. And again, I always like to look across the country too at other P's and T's and see if there's some lessons learned there or some direction that could be used. I don't know if you have any comment on that.
Brendan Handel, I guess my comment would be, we have professional accountants that can provide, that could sort of assist with that as well. I mean, TI are sort of the holders of the space, but of course, we could get involved in analysis, that sort of thing. We haven't in the past, but it's not to say that we couldn't.
And then rolling it in, and having had a background in environmental consulting previously, you know, the environmental liabilities, the public safety liabilities that are loading up on that. And I'm thinking, you know, from a public safety perspective and some issues, you know, children playing around a facility that's not safe, and some of that building escalating costs is more of an incentive to actually dispose of some of these assets. I'm thinking that there's need for some exercises there where at some point you say, we got to fish or cut bait, you know, as they say.
So thank you, MHA Chamber. We'll certainly, you know, we'll certainly take that under advisement, and, you know, you're making very good points on the use of government space.
Okay. I'm going to pause there. Pass it on to my colleague to the beautiful district of Cape St. Francis. Yeah.
All right, thank you. We'll now call upon the member for Cape St. Francis.
Thank you, Chair, and I wasn't expecting that from my colleague from Nick Melville. You don't normally pause.
But I recognize
you. You certainly did, and I appreciate that. Thank you all for coming here today. I have a couple of follow-up questions from my colleague from Central St. Mary's before I get into the other questions, because questions are stimulated by conversation. First of all, on the loans. It was noted 11 of 35 accounts were submitted for write-off. If I have the numbers correct from my taking notes. And so I looked at the other 24. You have 19 of 35 written off, one in process. We're down to 12, I believe you said this, right? So those 12 accounts, what about those? Will those be recoverable, or are you looking to for those to be written off as well?
So let me tell you all, good question. So our review, we looked at all the loans and chances of collectability on those loans. So I guess to summarize, the 12 loans that are remaining, in our opinion, they are collectible. So that's why they're remaining on the books. So the ones that could have been written off or should have been written off have been or are in the process of being written off.
Okay, thank you for that. With respect to inventory management, I do know that the AG has made some recommendations. And you did say about the spot checks that you wanted to implement for the departmental inventory. So I'm just wondering how those spot checks are going to be implemented, and do you have dedicated staff or officials to that to ensure that's done in a timely manner throughout the year?
Brendan Hanlon, so we have dedicated internal audit staff that are directed by an internal audit plan. So we will work the spot checks into our internal audit plan, and we do have dedicated, professional, knowledgeable staff that can carry out inventory spot checks. We'll do it across the province in different locations and different types of inventory to make sure we have, you know, a good scope and scale of all the inventory and make sure there's samples from, you know, all different areas. So that's our plan.
Okay. Thank you for that. And with respect to the AGs, she noted the inadequacies of the inventory management. On top of spot checks, any other new guidelines or anything else being implemented other than spot checks to deal with or to address her recommendation?
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately departments are responsible and required to have documented inventory management policies and practices in place. Of course, our job is to ensure they have those practices and policies in place. At our controller meetings, so I have quarterly meetings with all departmental controllers, we have stressed the importance of inventory and asset management over and over again. So those are the sort of steps we have taken in conjunction with the spot checks. We think it'll make, you know, it provides for a very robust inventory management protocol for the coming year.
Thank you for that. I'm happy to hear the quarterly meetings and to keep on top of that on a regular basis. Makes it much more easier going forward, no doubt. With respect to the unfunded pension, and specifically with the uniform, I've had several people reach out to me over the last number of years who are in that pension plan.
Yep.
Without breaching any confidentiality, one, a retired RNC sergeant whose pension is $9,800 a year. That's his pension from RNC after 26 years of service. So, again, from my notes, 25 to 26% is unfunded status. Is that correct? 25 to 26%. So, and you said that you couldn't provide a timeline, but you do have analysis ongoing with respect to that. So what options are being considered to look at that or to correct that unfunded liability?
It's the funded status, just to Elizabeth Lane, sorry. The fund, that's the funded status of the plan.
Thank you.
So we have for this plan as well, this is part of our pooled pension plan. There's three pension plans in that.
Yeah.
We have a pension investment committee. And the role of the committee is to advise the trustee on the operation and the investment of the pooled pension fund. So there is certainly oversight with respect to the funding statuses of all the plans involved in the pooled pension plans. So it would be part of their role to look at and assess any options moving forward with respect to the funding nature of the plan or any changes. Obviously, as well, when we look historically, there are two other plans back in 2015, the public service pension plan as well as the teachers' pension plan, that underwent significant reform, landing on a joint trusteeship arrangement with our unions. So, you know, there is, in terms of the analysis that's being done, it would be certainly premature of me to talk about where that may or may not land, as it is a government decision. However, you know, there is some history in terms of different options that we can look to, including whether or not the, you know, it would be, for example, what's been done with the previous plans in the past. So that would be included in the options. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Lane. I do appreciate that. I have had several conversations with the Minister of Finance regarding this, and I'm happy to hear that there is ongoing work on that. So thank you for that. I do have another question with respect to the offshore royalties and the carryback of decommissioning costs. So government has yet to determine the impact that carryback of decommissioning costs will have on offshore royalties. And, of course, these liabilities could be material, and appropriate accounting for them would be within the Canadian public sector accounting standards. So my question would be, what progress has government made on the work with the Department of IET to determine whether an estimate for decommissioning costs can actually be reached?
Brendan Hammond, so I'll just give an overview of what's happened in the last couple of years with respect to decommissioning costs. So the Office of Controller General discloses offshore royalty decommissioning carryback. Right now it's contingent liability. That's how we report it. So in 2022, an accounting assessment provided to the Office of the Auditor General supported this treatment due to the uncertainty regarding the decommissioning carryback impact on the royalty calculation liability status. So due to the sort of, you know, uncertainty around the amounts and if it would, you know, what the impact would be in the future, that's our assessment was that we would disclose it as a contingent liability. So we completed a review with the Department of IET in 2022 to confirm that existing accounting treatment. So we're continuing to work with IET now to review royalty regulations for its projects to see if any of new royalty regulations may impact disclosure requirements. That will help us determine if an estimate can be or should be established. We're going to ascertain how these costs will factor into the royalty calculations and identify any carryback amounts. And, you know, we're going to continually ensure that the appropriate accounting treatment is applied according to Canadian public sector accounting standards. So, you know, that's the sort of approach we've taken, and that's the plan for right now with respect to that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hanlon. I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair. That's all for now.
Thank you, Member for Cape St. Francis. Pleeman 4C, MHA for exploits. Just going through some of the questions there that already has been asked regards to inventories and that kind of stuff. How accurate is the information you receive from entities regarding, you know, are they incomplete or inaccurate? You know, how accurate are the information that you receive?
You mean in general?
In general, yes.
Okay, so I mean, I'll just sort of explain how it all works, and then we can just sort of go from there. So, you know, the year ends March 31st. There's a one-month write-back. So then we get submissions in from all departments and all government entities, you know, say in May period. So what we do is we do sort of a very robust analysis. So we have sort of Lisa and her very smart people that work in government accounting take all those submissions. They do analysis comparisons to previous years. They do trend analysis. They sort of go back with you know, literally hundreds of questions to departments and entities to sort of add validity to the submissions. Department submissions are accurate, but of course, like everything, we go through all of our process to ensure that the end product that comes out at the end of the day, government's financial statements, are as accurate as they can possibly be. There's a lot of back and forth. Lisa's crowd are literally doing hundreds of entries over the summer, working through all that sort of thing. So, you know, a combination of professional accountants in departments working with professional accountants in our office ensure that at the end of the day, those financial statements that we produce are as accurate as they can possibly be. And with the help of the Auditor General, of course.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Receivables of loans, do you have a percentage of the receivables for the recovery of loans, in regards to the loans and the receivables that you get back? Do you have a percentage of what you're getting back in regards to the recovery?
Brendan Hand. So I guess to say, so our receivable is like a really big number, like $3 billion. So 80% of that comes from federal government. So we're going to get 100% of that, most likely. When you look at our accounts receivable that could have any sort of allowance set up at all, it's about $300 million-ish, primarily income support and fines receivable. So sort of as I discussed earlier, there's analysis done on income support and on fines receivable to set up an appropriate allowance for doubtful accounts. That would be such and such percent. So that is sort of our estimation of what wouldn't be collected in the future. But of our overall receivable, a large chunk of that is like not quite 100% guaranteed, but as close as you're going to get to 100% guaranteed, and allowance is set up for the part that, you know, may not be collected in the future.
Thank you. Do you have a cost estimate of the assets to be retired? Do you have a cost estimate of what can be retired there and anything like that?
MHA 4C, unless Lisa has a better answer, I will certainly get that information for you. I don't have it at my fingertips, what we have set up as asset retirement obligations right now. But we have it. We can get it.
Okay, thank you. Following up with a couple more questions. What initiatives are being taken to ensure internal controls and accounting practices?
Brendan Hanlon. So I'll just go back to some of the sort of things we do during the year. So we meet with departmental controllers on a quarterly basis to stress the importance of following all internal controls and appropriate accounting practices. We especially meet with them around public account submission time to ensure all their submissions are accurate and up to date. We send detailed guidelines out to all entities and all departments on public account submission. If there are any issues that come up at all, we deal with departmental executive to ensure that those issues are remedied effectively and quickly. And we're continually working with departments on any issues that come up during the year. But, you know, Lisa's staff provide very clear documentation and instructions to all entities and departments with respect to all their submissions, you know, in conjunction with all the analysis they do, of course.
All right, thank you. The asset retirement obligation of 2023, $518 million. Okay. The stability of the province and fiscal situation remains a significant concern. What actions are being put in place to control the stability?
Michelle Jewer. So I guess I'll point to budget 2024, and there is a five-year fiscal forecast that is released as part of budget. In that budget, you'll see return to surplus in 25-26 of $58 million, and then there's small surpluses throughout the period up to 28-29. Of course, as part of budget 25, we're currently in the process of starting to develop budget 2025, so we'll have a new five-year forecast when that is released. So certainly that is, from a fiscal stability perspective, you can see getting return to surplus is something that certainly the bond rating agencies look to us for, and this is very important. Also, I'll mention on the debt side, on a debt management side, there's a number of things that we've done to deal with the substantial amount of debt that the province has on the books. So we did reestablish sinking funds for new debt issuances. So when there's a new debt issuance, there's a sinking fund of no less than 1.5% that has to go against that or has to be put in the sinking fund and invested to repay that debt when the debt becomes due. Usually our debt, well, our debt could be 5, 10, 30 years. Majority of our debt would be 30-year time frame. So that gives enough time to invest that sinking fund money to be able to repay that debt when it becomes due. We did make changes to the Financial Administration Act to optimize sinking fund performance as well. So we do have the ability to invest in a broader range of securities. So that allowed us to do municipal and highly rated corporate bonds, for example, and highly rated equity investments that are publicly listed on the S&P 500 or the TSX 60. We also established a future fund. So the future fund was established in 2022-23, where a portion of the province's non-renewable resource revenues and net proceeds from any sale of capital assets is invested in the future fund. We do have currently to date about $319 million in that future fund. So that's another step that government has taken to help stabilize the financial position. From an investor perspective, we have launched a European borrowing program. So our provincial bonds can now be traded in European markets, and that's the intention to attract additional investors to purchase our bonds, and then by generating that demand would hopefully reduce the cost of our debt. So that's just another step. That's been taken.
Okay, thank you. As of March the 31st, 2023, the province's accounts receivable line item amounts to $3.3 billion, with an allowance of doubtful accounts totally of $122.2 million. Of this, a significant portion has been outstanding for several years, with only $1.5 million written off. Does the Office of the Controller General intend to review the accounts receivable, including doubtful accounts, to identify outstanding balances and when they can be written off?
Brendan Hanlon. I'll just sort of provide a bit of context around the big receivable number. It is a big number, $3.4 billion. So $2.8 billion of that is due from the Government of Canada. So that's sort of, you know, we would never write that off or set up an allowance. That's practically guaranteed money. That's 80% of the receivable. Tax receivable and offshore royalties make up about another 10%. And so the remaining 10% is mainly income support and fines receivable, accounts receivable. So we have been working with departments to sort of ensure that the allowances set up are the correct amounts. We have been stressing the importance of submitting write-offs from departments as required. And we will be continuing to do so. And you can check with CSSD this afternoon, but I do believe they're also sort of taking a review of their sort of process around setting up their allowance for doubtful account amounts, you know, to make sure it's sort of up to date and in tune with the current balance that's in their accounts receivable portfolio. So those are steps we're taking. And I'll also add, you know, with our quarterly meetings with controllers, we are stressing the importance of focusing on writing off accounts that are no longer collectible because, you know, it's not appropriate to have them on the books any longer.
Thank you. One quick question. Decommissioning. Have any decommissioning costs been established?
So Lisa can kick me if I'm wrong. But my understanding is that no, there have been none to date. Lisa's nodding. There have been none to date.
All right, see, my time is up. I'll continue with the member for Mount Pearl North.
Thank you, Chair. A couple of more questions. Groups like the egg farmers and that who have not provided any financial information. I'm just wondering what measures your office have taken to try and obtain those financial information.
Brendan Hanlon. So I'm pleased to report, after some compelling, they have submitted their financial statements as requested for 2024. So those were sort of the last outstanding set, and you know, they have now submitted them to our office.
So has everybody else compliance as well with, you know, besides the bargaining board, have everybody else complied? And the other question is, can you, your department, put any policies in place to sort of force them to give you the information?
Brendan Hanlon. So as of right now, everyone is compliant with submitting their financial statements to my office as required, to our office. So, I mean, with respect to sort of legal requirements, but, I mean, of course, we're working with entities all the time. We work with departments who sort of, you know, oversee entities. So we take whatever steps we need to work with departments and to work with entities to ensure they have submitted the required financial information to our office.
So the CNLOPD consolidation, has that partnership been put in place? And what have your department done to make that happen?
Brendan Hanlon. So I guess there's been a long outstanding question of whether the CNLOPB should be included in the government reporting entity or not. So analysis done by our office in the past, the issue comes around shared control over the CNLOPB. So just to sort of, I'll just explain how it works. So the province has three members on the board. The federal government has three members on the board. Quorum is four members. So there could be an instance where the federal government has three members at a meeting and the province has one member at a meeting. So therefore, that wouldn't really be shared control. All that being said, we are taking another look at this to see if, you know, just make sure we're consistent across all our entities and consistent across other provinces to see how they deal with the CNLOPB. So it's not a closed case. We're currently reviewing whether they should be in or not, but that's sort of the circumstances around why the decision was made at this time for them not to be included.
So looking at the whole report, is there anything coming out of you that wasn't looked at in the other general's report that your department should take a high priority on?
Brendan Hanlon, tricky question. What I will say is that, you know, in general, our internal audit have their audit plan that they work on all year long. That may be different issues than the Auditor General brings up in their Auditor General report. And that's sort of the point for all of us to sort of be looking at different areas to have good coverage in our respective audit plans. So, you know, our internal audit group could look at a different issue that hadn't come up. And that's sort of how we, you know, how we operate during the year. So it's possible we could look at things that the Auditor General haven't looked at, for instance. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you. I was going to ask that question then. If you looked at your own department would make changes, and you basically said you could look at making changes without the Auditor General coming forward and doing and suggesting that something is not up to par or up to speed.
Brendan Hanlon, just a comment. Yeah, so we are proactive in working with departments and, you know, identifying areas where improvements can be made. You know, we all want to see improvement wherever it can be made. So, yes, our office work with departments continually through our quarterly meetings and otherwise to make improvements wherever they can be made.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to move on.
Thank you. We'll ask the member for Placentia, St. Mary's.
Thank you, Chair. I do have some questions, just some clarity required. Timing of the consolidated summary financial statements. Am I hearing that the Office of Comptroller General is not considering or has no consideration to probably implement any other business process that would reduce or change the time of the tabling of the public accounts?
Brendan Hanlon. So we have made, I guess, a number of steps to improve on the timeliness of the of the public accounts. Let me just have a quick look here now. So right now there are no legislative changes planned, but of course our office are always looking for operational improvements to shorten the public accounts timeline. So additional resources were added the past year, an additional public accounts analyst, accounting research specialist, and accountant in the public accounts group. We provide detailed training to staff to improve efficiency in business processes. Reviewed and documentation has been updated. We added more milestones to our internal schedule to assess, monitor, and make progress towards goals and take corrective action as required. We implemented additional quality assurance procedures to ensure the accuracy of the information and working papers provided for audit and to verify the accuracy and completeness, because of course if more accurate and complete information comes in, less time will be required on the back end. And we feel like we've enhanced our communication with the auditor, Office of the Auditor General to address audit issues and audit information requests on a timely basis. So those are steps we've taken. And of course, we're always looking to improve the timelines on our public accounts. And I would just like to add that, you know, we are meeting our legislative required timeline, which is November 1st every year.
Okay, thank you very much for that. So that somewhat answers my other, another question that I have. Just want some clarity on. I was going to ask, like, how does the Office of Controller General plan to work with the departments to improve the quality of the public accounts submissions? Because after reading the report, it highlights or lends to or suggests, not sure what word to use here, that there appears to be probably not enough capacity in the departments, that information may be entered wrong, it's incomplete when it's received. I mean, you did allude to the fact that you analyze it and go back with additional questions. But when reading the report, these things do come out without any information. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. Brendan Hanlon. So, you know, we're dealing with a large number of departments. Submission quality is going to range across departments for sure. So that's why we're providing additional training. The templates we try to provide as accurate and as really good instructions as we can, clear instructions to the departments so that the templates are filled out correctly. Again, we re-emphasize through our quarterly departmental controller meetings the importance of having accurate information. And, you know, we have professional accountants that can work with departments' finance divisions, you know, to assist them in compiling their information if required as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. And one last question. I'm just wondering, how is government continuing to promote? I just first I want to say that I have noticed that the zero tolerance culture for fraud is greatly improved over the last 4 or 5 years. It's really good. So I'm just wondering, how are you going to continue to promote this zero tolerance culture for fraud?
Elizabeth Lane. So you're right, government has a zero tolerance policy for fraud. It's a fairly robust fraud management program, actually, that government has, which includes the policy, prevention and detection measures, awareness and education, and reporting, robust reporting measures, outlined for investigations, as well as a fraud risk assessment. And government has, in terms of the, in addition to the policy, government has a mandatory fraud prevention and detection training as well. So that is mandatory throughout core government. Fraud risk surveys are a tool as well that is completed annually through the Office of the Controller General with all departments to identify areas for the OCG to focus on to mitigate the risk of fraud. There are also, as well, and my colleagues can comment more specifically on this, but there are also dedicated professional development days on financial issues, including fraud, so that occurs. And also the Office of the Controller General, as well as the Office of the Auditor General, are notified of reported cases, all reported cases of fraud as well. And I'll leave it there for now, unless you have further questions.
No, that's it. Thank you very much. And that is it for me, Chair.
Okay, thank you. We'll move to the member for Lab West.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question here on when it comes to, recovery of funds from delinquent accounts or anything like that, how much was spent, or are you keeping track of how much is spent on trying to recover this money? And does it exceed the amount that you're trying to recover?
Brendan Hanlon and CSSD can provide further clarification. No, sorry, DGSNL. So the collection unit in government resides with DGSNL. So, you know, they could tell you the exact amount of money they spend on basically their collection officers. You know, the cost to collect is basically the cost of collection officers. But, you know, if they put somebody, say, for instance, in federal set-off, there is no cost. I mean, anything that's recovered from the income tax payment is 100% returned to government. There's no fee. There's no anything like that. So really the cost of government to collections are the collection officers. And I was departmental controller with HR Lee years ago, and I can assure you the benefit from collection officers greatly outweighs the cost of a collection officer, like many, many times, I would suggest.
Thank you so much for that. Background on that. Also, when it comes to information management, I know that in the report and that the Auditor General talked about, you know, some of the gathering information, data, and accuracy, and that I was wondering if there's any improvements or anything like that has since the time of this report have been put through your office to improve that information management and gathering. I know that the Auditor General did have some concerns in the past about that.
MHA Brown, you mean like IT control type thing?
Yes, or? IT control. Okay.
So the OCIO right now, as I understand it, we got an update from those guys. So they're actively reviewing all policies, are in the process of creating a new policy framework, which will include a formal review process. So that work has begun and will continue into 2025 with an OCIO resource dedicated to lead this initiative. So they have taken that recommendation very seriously and have dedicated resources and would be working on developing a whole new policy framework around all the recommended options this year.
I guess one final question on there. The programming and the systems that are being used by your department for financial tracking and everything like that, when was the last time all those systems have been reviewed or been updated for, especially with security features and things like that? When was the last time that was done?
MHA Brown, Brendan Hanlon. So we're continually updating our security processes and internal control processes with our financial systems. We have a very, very robust financial system with a lot of many, many safeguards in place. I guess you could just look at the history of upgrades done with our Oracle system, and you could sort of, you know, it's sort of evident from how it operates that there are not many issues that come up because of the security that's in place and all the procedures that are currently in place for our financial system. It's very robust.
Thank you. No further questions, Chair.
Thank you. We'll move to the member for Lake Melville.
Thank you, Chair. This may be a question later this afternoon for the CEO, Pat Parfrey, but I just wondered your thoughts on the $600 million a line of credit that's been created by our regional health authorities, and whether or not you see a hope for optimism now that we've got all four combined and in terms of controls. It's been interesting, sitting on this committee, and as we've done other investigations, the tremendous difference between each of the four regional health authorities over the last several years. I'm a big fan of what's happening, and I just wondered if you share that level of optimism.
So, Michelle Dewar, certainly to your point, Dr. Parfrey was probably can speak to this afternoon. As I mentioned before, Department of Finance and Treasury Board Secretariat work with the Department and NLHS around that line of credit is concerning. It's a high number. And we did put money in the budget last year to help address that. So just to want to repeat part of your question again.
I'm just wondering now that we're combining all four regional health authorities into one, that alone should help addressing, unanticipated overruns and the need to borrow, that kind of thing. Four.
Yeah, for sure. I think they're currently in the process of amalgamating into one system. I think that will certainly provide efficiencies. They're not yet there yet, but that's the plan to bring them all under the one system, right?
Have you been aware of when that financial aspect of the combination would be complete by?
I don't have time frames, but again, us and Treasury Board Secretariat are working with them on that solution.
Thank you. Next thought is, and it's just a thought, I was just doing a little, dare I say, some Google searching there, but just looking at well decommissioning, and it frustrates me to see us giving up royalties to go back and deal with abandoned wells. Alberta doesn't really have it any better, but it's a substantial issue in Alberta as well, and it's a levy that's applied to the industry. I'm just wondering if you have any advice for looking at future offshore deals and what we might do. I'm looking around the country to see if there's a better way. I'm not sure I see one right now.
Brendan Hanlon, you know, we work with IET on the sort of accounting side of things to see if a liability should be set up for decommissioning and whatnot. And I would suggest that IET may be the best positioned to sort of outline how that may or may not impact future royalty agreements in the future. You know, because we're involved on the accounting side, we set up contingent liabilities for the future. But other than that, of course, our expertise is not in that sort of realm.
My last question is it back to the timing of financial reporting and the steps you've taken. That sounds positive. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about. It's kind of a setup question. I don't mean to do that to you, but it's really like, how do we move ourselves up the line in terms of being compared to across the country? Are there big structural changes, and or my thought is, and back to one of my colleague's questions on the quality of the information that's coming in, maybe some of these other provinces and territories are getting their information in sooner, but perhaps it's not to the same quality. I don't know, but it was just something that the AG noted to us.
Brendan Hanlon, so, you know, the structural change that would have to happen that's other provinces do, that's different to Newfoundland and Labrador, is that our accounting systems and our budgets are done on a modified cash basis as opposed to an accrual basis. So as a result, when the year ends, we need to do literally, Lisa and her staff, hundreds of accrual entries to bring the books from a cash basis to an accrual basis. So, you know, that sort of process takes, you know, a long while. We have to get all the information from departments and entities. What other jurisdictions do is, you know, they may have accrual financial accrual system set up and accrual budget set up, which would cut down the amount of time required. But right now, as the Financial Administration Act is structured, you know, it sort of leads us to the modified cash basis. So the thing that would have to happen, and may or may not happen in the future, would be amendments basically to the Financial Administration Act and large changes to our financial systems, which of course would be costly and time-consuming. But, you know, it's a project that could be considered in the future. But that is the main reason why, you know, we're pushing up into September, October, and others may get it done a bit sooner.
How do we compare? I mean, are other jurisdictions following the same modified cash basis? And are we there? Are we unique in the Federation?
Lisa could say if we're unique or not, but, you know, a large number do accrual accounting and have an accounting system set up. You know, we're on the tail end of when public accounts get submitted, you know, but they're always within the legislative timeline, which is sort of the most important thing for us to make sure we meet legislative timelines. But, of course, this year we're going to implement the things I've talked about to reduce our timeline as much as possible.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. We'll move to the member for Cape St. Francis.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks to my colleague from Lab West. I'm down to one question. Good questions and good answers, thank you. With respect, and I don't think this one has been asked, I went back to my notes, I didn't think it was, forgive me if it has been. The AG noted deficiencies in the reporting of asset retirement obligations, investments, loans receivable, and the disclosures related to account receivables, long-term debt, and contractual obligations need to be further assessed from the AG's office. So my last question is, how is the Office of the Comptroller General reviewing its disclosure requirements?
Gee, I made it all this way, and then I just forgot the button once. Well, I got too comfortable. Brendan Hanlon. So the Office of the Comptroller General has completed a detailed review of each of the disclosure areas noted. Assessments were completed to determine if additional disclosure in the public accounts is required by the Canadian Public Sector Accounting Standards. So disclosure in the 2024 public accounts were updated accordingly as required. So these disclosures included asset retirement obligations, investments, loans receivable, and accounts receivable. So those have been updated in the 2024 public accounts.
Thank you, Mr. Hanlon. I appreciate that. That's my last question, Chair. I appreciate the panel's time and answers for today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Pleeman Forcing MHA Exploits. Do have a couple more questions, actually. When we spoke about decommissioning, you know, when we asked if there have any decommissioning costs been established, you just said no. Why, or, you know, why not, hasn't any decommissioning cost been done?
Brendan Hanlon. So ultimately, I can just sort of go back to the things we have done. So we do disclose decommissioning carryback as a contingent liability. That's sort of accounting treatment and stance the opposite of Controller General has taken on the topic. After discussion with the IET, and, you know, we feel that this is the appropriate accounting treatment to make. I mean, there is a difference of opinion with the Office of the Auditor General. I mean, we feel the disclosures are a contingent liability and currently the appropriate accounting treatment. And we have an accounting discussion paper provided to the OAG that was provided for feedback in 2022. And we continue to review and monitor with IET for any changes or new information that may change our disclosure position. But, you know, as I said, it is a difference of opinion with the Office of the Auditor General at this time.
Okay, thank you. What is being done to ensure spending is controlled and debt loads reduced?
Michelle Jewart. So I'll refer again to Budget 2024 and the fiscal forecast. So you'll note again, return to surplus in 25-26 as part of Budget 2024. So from a spend perspective, you can see that coming out of the deficit would be inherent in controlling some of that spend. Some of that, of course, is additional revenue as well, coming into the forecast. So with respect to, you had asked about managing the debt, correct? Yeah. So I'll mention the things that we've done around managing debt, putting sinking funds against any new issuance of debt. So there is a period of time where there were no sinking funds attached to new debt. So I think it's probably in the range of $16 billion or so that has no sinking funds attached to it. So there's, we did reestablish that. So now that we do issue a debt, then there is 1.5% of that gets put into a sinking fund and that gets invested. And then by the time the debt becomes due, there should be sinking funds there to pay off that debt. So from a fiscal sustainability perspective, that is an important measure that was put in place. Also with the sinking funds, traditionally it was pretty, the Financial Administration Act was pretty strict on what could be invested. So we did make some changes, as I mentioned, to be able to invest in broader things to allow for a greater return. So for sinking funds, for example, for 23-24, the approximate return was 5.6% on those funds. Our cost of borrowing is approximately, current year, about 4.5%. So you can see they were investing more than what the cost of the debt would be. And then the establishment of the sinking of the future fund, I mentioned as well. So a certain portion of non-renewable resources goes into the future fund and then gets invested. And for 23-24, the return on the future fund was about 6.7%, just to give you some indications there.
Okay, thank you. So what is being done to address the rising debt servicing costs? We're looking at over $1 billion per year.
Michelle Jewer. So again, I mentioned the expansion into the European borrowing programs in order to increase demand for our bonds would hopefully then lower that cost of debt. Certainly from the bond rating agencies, as I mentioned, they're looking for return to surplus as an important aspect to how they rate our bonds. So that is a positive, a credit positive, we'll call it, when they look at how they rate the province with respect to bond rating. So those two things for sure. Return to surplus, keep managing the costs, increasing revenue, obviously reducing that reliance on having to borrow is important. That would obviously reduce the cost of the debt as well.
Okay, thank you. What is the sustainability of reliance on oil revenues and federal transfers?
So, Michelle Jewer. So, for budget 2024, I believe the percentage of oil royalties to revenue was 15%. Back in 2011-12, it was 32%. So then that's the natural decline of the reliance on oil in the forecast. For federal transfers perspective, I'm just going to get the number here. For 23-24, 20.3% of our revenue was federal revenue. So the majority of the revenue is what we call own source revenue. So coming from, as I said, like income taxes, corporate taxes, sales tax, oil royalties, those sorts of things.
Okay, thank you. What is being done to reduce that reliance on the oil revenues?
Michelle Jewer. So again, you can see the, as I mentioned, going, it was 32% and down to 15 as part of budget 2024. So there is that reduction. It's about, I think, diversification of the revenues, revenue streams coming in. So to have that more different revenue sources coming in would then reduce that reliance on oil. For example, I'll just mention the wind hydrogen as an example of a new source of revenue that would be coming into the province.
Okay, thank you. Just a couple more questions, I guess. While auditing the consolidated summary financial statements, the Auditor General noted numerous instances of information that required correction from the Office of the Comptroller General. How is the Office of the Comptroller General working to reduce errors associated with the modified cash basis of accounting?
Brendan Hanlon. So we've taken a number of steps, taking the recommendation into account. So, we're committed to reducing errors and promoting improvements in financial reporting throughout government, our offices. So departments are provided deep, detailed instructions for public accounts templates and a deadline that allows our office to review the submissions and ensure proper completion. Consolidated entities receive detailed completion instructions and a sufficient deadline for the Office of the Comptroller General review. The Department of Finance and the Office of the Comptroller General have partnered to provide professional development days. So we've done professional development days where public accounts, reporting, and internal audit are discussed with financial professionals throughout government. We meet regularly with departmental controllers with public accounts as a standing agenda item, and issues are noted and raised with the group. And, you know, we do our analysis and reasonableness review on all submissions, to try and avoid correction errors in the future. We like to have accurate, timely submissions in from all departments, and we're making extra effort, and we'll continue to make extra effort to make sure that those submissions are as accurate as they can be in the future.
Thank you. Does the OCG intend to move to accrual accounting?
Ultimately, the financial statements of the province are provided on an accrual accounting basis, but the Financial Administration Act, the Financial Administration Act as it currently exists, requires a modified cash basis of accounting, so that will require legislative changes. So there are no legislative changes planned at this time, I can say.
All right, my time is just a bit close there, so I do have a couple more questions, but I'll move on down the line just in case there's any extra questions, and I'll follow up with with a couple of questions after that. So I'll ask member for Mount Pearl North, do you have any more questions?
No, I don't. Thank you again for coming this morning.
Member for Placentia St. Mary's?
No more questions from me. Thank you very much for your contribution.
Member for Lab West?
Thank you, Chair. I have no more questions, and I thank our guests for providing information today.
Thank you. Member for Lake Melville?
Thank you, Chair. It's not a question, it's a comment and maybe a compliment. And back to the Deputy Minister, I was just doing some rough calculations in your investment strategy on the sinking fund. So that would represent somewhere between, am I getting this right, 8 to 10 million per billion dollars? Is that what we're actually gaining there through your investment strategy? Is that what, did I get that right? I was looking at the percentages. You had 5.8 and then 4.6. And so that's about $10 million per billion. Is that what we're?
Michelle Jewer, I'd have to do the calculations.
Yeah.
I had to get back to you to confirm. But so for sinking funds, for example, the balance is about, so $1.5 billion is what we have in sinking funds currently. And we have about a 5.6% return on that for the year, right, for 23-24.
Oh, okay.
Right? The future fund, there's $390 million in that.
Yeah,
right?
But so, it's back. But the difference, the way you're investing, is actually generating substantial, many millions of dollars. I'm thinking it's 8 to 10 million per billion. I'm not sure if I got that right or not. But I just wonder, how do we enter that into the budget? How is that showing up? That as a revenue, and how is it labeled?
So it would be investment income. Would be Michelle Jewer. Would be investment income on the income statement that would show up. The sinking funds actually come off of our borrowings, so in our liabilities. So, yeah.
On your borrowing costs, yeah. No, I just want to say that's good. Thank you. And thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, thank you. Member for Cape St. Francis.
Thank you, Chair. No further questions. Thank you to all of you for coming out today and providing your answers to us. It's appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'll follow up with a couple more questions. The Auditor General noted deficiencies in the reporting of asset retirement obligations, investments, and loans receivables. How does the Office of the Comptroller General, how is the Office of the Comptroller General reviewing disclosure requirements?
Brendan Hanlon. So we completed a detailed review of all disclosure areas that were noted by the Auditor General. So disclosures in the 2024 public accounts were updated accordingly as required. So we did update asset retirement obligations, investments, loans receivable, and accounts receivable for the 2024 public accounts. So we took the recommendation under advisement and updated our disclosure requirements accordingly.
Okay, thank you. During the audit of the Officer General's notes, four instances in which it took 60 or more days for the Office of the Comptroller to complete bank reconciliations. How is the Office of the Comptroller General improving its turnaround time for the preparation of bank reconciliations?
Brendan Hanlon, so we have a sort of very clear review of all bank reconciliations now. They're all up to date meaning within 60 days is the requirement of the Auditor General. So as you said, there were four instances noted. We reviewed all those four instances and we put processes in place to ensure that going forward, all bank reconciliations are completed in a timely manner.
Thank you. I do have one more question. That's it. The Auditor General report notes three risk included in government's financial statement discussions and analysis that potentially can have significant effects on the province's economic and fiscal position. How is government using using the risk of highlighted in financial statement discussion analysis to inform decision making and spending priorities?
Just to be clear, is this talking about rate mitigation and demographic issues? Is
that yes. Yes.
Okay. So first, just on rate mitigation. So the finalization of the rate mitigation plan with Newfoundland Hydro was announced in May 2024, effective July 2024, whereby domestic residential power rate increases associated with Muskrat Falls cost recovery are capped at 2.25% per annum. So that's sort of something that's been done with respect to rate mitigation. With respect to aging demographics, government makes investments in the province to make it a beneficial place to live and sort of raise your family. And we are working on our immigration policies and work with, and IPGS does a very good job of dealing with enhancing immigration within the province. So those are sort of steps that have been taken demographically. Elizabeth, I don't know if you had anything
to add to that. Yeah.
So, Michelle Dewar, so if you look at, again, Budget 2024 from a demographic perspective and look at population indicators, we do see population growth in the economic forecast. That's the first time we've seen growth in many, many years. But if just to give you an example, from 2023 to 2024, we have, in 2023, population was 539,000. We had about 9,800 net migration from immigration, international, and interprovincial. And then we had a natural change in birth, about 3,500 of deaths. Of deaths over births, about 3,500. So a net of 545, 300 in the population perspective. So seeing population growth in the forecast, as Bren has mentioned, there is certainly the demographic of 75 plus does grow in the forecast as well. But that is taken into consideration when we look at, in general, population and population growth.
Okay, I think that probably may end the questioning. Just taking one quick look around, no questions. So I'll ask the entities if there are any closing remarks on their matter.
Elizabeth Lane, on behalf, I'm sure, of Treasury Board Secretariat, which includes the Office of the Comptroller General, and I'm sure Department of Finance as well, we're very happy to appear and provide the the information as requested by the committee, and we thank you for the questions and the opportunity. Thank you.
And Brendan Hanlon, just briefly, I'd like to thank Lisa and her staff for all the work they do on public accounts. Excellent job they do every year on public accounts. So I just want to thank her and her staff, and I'd like to thank you guys for inviting us here to answer the questions.
Okay, thank you. I'll ask the Deputy Auditor General if there's any closing remarks on her part.
Hi, Sandra Russell, Deputy Auditor General. I just wanted to thank the Public Accounts Committee for having this hearing that addresses the public accounts. There are several jurisdictions that don't get this opportunity. I just think it's such an important part of our work, and it's just such a great experience to have these issues addressed in this public forum. I'm very pleased to see some of the responses on some of the recommendations we made and see things that are being addressed, and very much looking forward to working with the Office of the Comptroller General and doing whatever we can to make a more timely tabling of the public accounts in the future. Just thank you. It's been a great hearing.
Okay, thank you. On behalf of the Public Accounts, I'd certainly like to thank all the entities for appearing before us this morning and answering the questions that we had. And it's nice to hear the comments from the Deputy Auditor General that through the Public Accounts that she's got some more conclusions to what she's been looking for. So that's a good to see that. Other than that, again, thank you for coming in. And with that, we'll take a recess now, and we'll return at 1 p.m. to proceed with the hearings. Thank you.